Okay, it's 9 o'clock, so I think I'll get started. We have our first talk of the day in the session, and it is by Eva Tchaikovska Higgins and Martin Holmes, and the title is Technology and Documentation, TEI and the Nha Akuchin Dictionary.
We'd like to begin with several acknowledgments. So first of all, we'd like to say how grateful we are for the chance to be here on the land of the Hawaiian people. And then we'd also like to acknowledge Sharon Covington and Ernie Brooks, who's sitting down here, who are from the Nha Akuchin Language Program and who are working on the project with us. And also two other team members, Sarah Kell and Caitlin Byrd, who are in Victoria. This project started with Dale Kincaid, the late great Salish scholar, and also with the fluent speakers that he shared in Nha Akuchin language with him in the 1960s and 70s. And it's being completed at the request of elders who worked with me and Dale in the 1990s. One of the elders, Mary Marchand, was the daughter of the two speakers that Dale worked with the most closely, and Mary is currently very ill, and so we wanted to dedicate this talk to her. She and Pauline Stensgar, who is also an elder, have been working on this project as well. And finally, we're grateful to Colville Tribes, who are supporting this project, and the agencies listed on the slide who provided funding. So the focus of our project today is the use of TEI, which is a coding initiative that isn't used that much, as far as we know, for endangered language lexical resource projects. But we'll start out with talking about the background, a little bit of background, and then Martin will talk about TEI, and then at the end, we'll talk a little bit about comparing different kinds of standards. Okay, so today, the purpose of the project is to construct and make publicly available rich and extensive lexical documentation of Nha Akuchin. And this was, as I said, recorded in the 60s and 70s with approximately 22 speakers. Some were in their 80s and 90s at the time, and so these are essentially legacy materials. And we want to try to create from these legacy materials lexical resources that are both enduring and also reusable in various formats and for various purposes, including as a print dictionary and also a searchable, extendable web-based database which can be used in different ways and for different purposes such as learning, teaching, language revitalization, and scholarship. Now, for purposes of this presentation, we're going to refer to the language examples as data, although, of course, we should keep in mind that the language materials are, in fact, a precious record of the linguistic heritage of Colville tribes, and from that perspective, they're much more than data. These are the team members, so we have people working with us at Colville tribes and also at the University of Victoria, and I've mentioned most of us. So Nha Akuchin was spoken traditionally in north central Washington state, and it is one of the seven interior Salish languages. There are 23 languages in the Salish family altogether. And since 1870, the peoples who spoke Nha Akuchin historically have been confined to the Colville Reservation by presidential executive order, together with eight other nomadic tribes. There are four varieties of Nha Akuchin. And roughly 3,500 tribal members are descended from Nha Akuchin-speaking families. In 2013, there are two fluent and active speakers, although there are quite a lot of other semi-fluent speakers. And the Nha Akuchin language program has been active for many years. The initial purpose of the project was started in 1991, and it was based on Dale Kincaid's field notes and how he had transformed these notes into data on file cards. And the initial purpose was to create a print dictionary which contained rich morphological information and was organized according to root morphemes and lexicalized stems. And so this is an example of the initial kind of target. This is Dale's Dale Kincaid's Upper Chehalis Dictionary. And so you can see at the left-hand corner there's a root morpheme, and then the words are broken down to morphological parts, and there's information about the speakers and so on. So this is what we started with, and it's obviously affected the current stage of the dictionary as well. And these are just Dale's file cards. He used these little yellow slips of paper. There are thousands of them, and they're in these kinds of boxes. And currently, we've got them in this Rubbermaid container because Vic installed sprinkler system. And it went off. Yeah, so this is kind of what a file card looked like. So you can see in the left-hand corner a root morpheme, and then there's two different typewriters were used. One, an early manual typewriter, which usually has phonetic transcription, and then when Dale started using the electric typewriter, that was the point at which he was phonemicizing the forms. He provided glosses, information about who shared the form with him, and also he sometimes put in penciled notes, like in this case he's indicating that this particular root is probably cognate with curdling form. Okay, so in 1991 the data were input into a computer program called Lexware. Lexware was developed by Bob Hsu here at the University of Hawaii. Some of you may know about it. It's an amazing software program. And it used a band format, including band names, headwords, numbering, and spaces to create a hierarchical system of embedding sub-entries within entries. And so this is what a Lexware entry looked like. This is a printout. So again, we have the headword or the root at the top, and then we have various sub-entries, and then reflecting morphological, derivational, and inflectional information.
I first got involved in the project in 2005 when Eva came to us and said, all my data is on this machine and it stopped working. So we were able to pull the hard drive out of the machine. We couldn't boot the machine. We got the hard drive out of the machine. We were able to find the WordPerfect files that had been used as Lexware, and we pulled those off and we took a look at them, and this is what we saw. And the white on black bits are non-printing characters. The others are things that you'll be familiar with if you've ever seen character encoding problems in a document. And we had no idea what to do with this. It turned out that the Lexware binary data, which was in WordPerfect, was dependent on WordPerfect for DOS. And we could handle that. We could run a virtual machine. We could start WordPerfect for DOS. That was OK. But they had used customized character sets, which we did not have. They were using obsolete printer fonts on a printer that no longer worked, and we could not find a way to use those printer fonts. And finally, to see it on the screen, we needed a Hercules graphics card, which wouldn't fit in any computer that we had nowadays. Now, I bet you've all been here at some point. We had 3 months of misery. Greg Newton and I, who did the recovery work, we did a presentation at Digital Humanities 2008 in Finland on how we went through that process, and we actually wrote a software program which we've used for other rescue projects since. We don't have time to go into it, although it's kind of interesting. But these were the lessons we learned, and we've all learned these lessons. They're obvious. Hardware goes away, software goes away, only your data is left, and you have better be able to use your data. Now, it is obvious, but we forget it, and we keep making the same mistakes over and over again, so it's worth repeating. Now, when we did rescue the data, our main determination was that we would never have to rescue the data again. So from now on, we obviously chose Unicode. You have to do that. We decided to use XML because it's a stable, mature standard. Virtually all serious schemas for data encoding these days are XML schemas. And we had to pick a candidate for a schema. And at the time in 2005, there was no LMF, it wasn't an ISO standard yet. And when we looked around, we couldn't find anything that was a good candidate, except for TEI, which we knew very well because we work in digital humanities, and it's basically the go-to tool in digital humanities. So that's what we chose. Now, for those of you who don't know much about TEI, some of you will, some of you won't, the Text Encoding Initiative is a large consortium of lots of different universities and institutions and individual members, and it has been around since the 80s and early 90s. They started releasing schemas and guidelines around about the middle 90s. And its main deliverables, the main things that the TEI produces, are schemas and guidelines and schema-related tools. Now, the guidelines to text encoding, the TEI guidelines, runs to about 1,600 pages in a PDF these days. It's very large, very complicated. It grows by accretion over time, and so it's substantial. It's used throughout digital humanities. All of our digital humanities students are familiar with the TEI. Encoding in TEI is basic literacy for them, and we have lots of projects using TEI. So for us, it was a natural choice. There are regular releases of TEI schemas. About every 6 months, a point release comes out. Thousands of other projects we can look to, lots of support, and lots of tools for TEI. So we're very comfortable with it. And chapter 9 of the TEI guidelines is the chapter on dictionaries, which outlines a module for encoding print, historical and modern print dictionaries, as well as born digital lexica like the one that we're working on right now. Now, TEI, as I said, is large and getting bigger all the time. The count I did before I left to come here, there are 543 elements and 463 attributes. That's substantial. That's really, nobody uses all of the TEI for a single project. It comes with a system for customization and constraint called the ODD system. One document does it all, is what ODD stands for. And what you do for your project is you create an ODD file, which is an XML document, in which you select and exclude the modules that you want, the tags and attributes that you want to use, and you can customize the values of those attributes where the TEI leaves them open, you can constrain them, and you basically refine down the TEI to be the kind of schema that you need exactly for your project. And that can be an iterative process as your project goes on. From the ODD file, you generate your schemas. Now, TEI comes with a tool called Romo, which will generate ETDs if you really need an ETD. RNG and RNC, the two relaxing schemas, and XML schema, the XSD format. So you can choose between those. We tend to use the RNG because that's the native format of TEI these days. Once you have your schemas, our research assistants work on the XML directly. They don't use any GUI tool or anything like that. They encode XML. We use the Oxygen XML editor, which is a great tool. This is a little screenshot from the editor which shows that because of the way we've customized our ODD file and generated our schema, if you're completing the role attribute here in this particular element, it's going to show you all the options that are available, and if you select one, it's going to gloss that, give you an explanation of what it means. So that makes it easy for our RAs to work on the XML encoding. The other thing that the ODD file will give us is documentation. You can generate documentation in PDF, HTML, EPUB, Word, all sorts of different formats directly from the ODD file. You get your detailed project documentation of all the tags and attributes and choices that you've made. We're running a bit short of time, so I'm going to kind of skip over this. This is the basic structure of a TEI entry, the way the XML structure works for a TEI entry. And this is an example of one of our entries. I want to focus on two specific things. We could spend all day talking about the actual encoding here, but the main features that are important for this talk are that each individual morpheme has its own entry, whether or not it's a standalone morpheme, whether it's a root or a stem, or it's an affix, or whatever it is, has its own entry, and the entry has a feature structure. TEI feature structures are basically identical to the ISO standard. And each entry has an XML ID, which you can see in red. Now, the XML ID is human readable. We don't use huge long GUIDs because we want our data to be human readable. We generate those from the phonemic representation according to a set of rules. Each polymorphemic item is linked through its hyph element, which is the morpheme breakdown using morpheme tags, to each of the constituent morphemes that compose it. So there are three segments here, each, the first two linked to individual morphemes, and the third one linked to two different morphemes at final end. That enables us to do this. Now, I was going to do this on the live site, but it'll be a bit quicker with the screenshots. When you display an entry, you can see the morpheme breakdown of the entry there. You can click on an individual morpheme, and you can pull up the entry for that morpheme in the context of the entry that you're looking at. And then there's a link there to other entries containing that morpheme, and you can pull up all of those entries directly in the context you're in. And then if you click on any of those, you'll get the entry for those. So you can drill down, and you can do that infinitely, although the size of your screen is going to limit how useful that would be. So that was one of our primary objectives, to make it easy to move around in the dictionary, in the interface of the dictionary. Now, we've seen how we've encoded our entries in TEI XML, but our project is not just the entries. We also have a lot of people associated with the project, like Sharon and Ernie, are the original informants from the field work, and RAs and the team working on the project right now. We want to record information about all of those people. We're basically building a personography. And TEI comes with tags for personographies. So we can just include those tags in our schema, and we can use them, and we can build a personography, include information about birth dates, death dates, relationships, all of that kind of stuff. We're getting increasingly interested in toponyms, place names. And as we start to document that information, we can use TEI tags for that. There are place tags with methods of encoding GIS coordinates and all of that kind of stuff. We're building a website, as you've seen. We can do all of the website pages in TEI using all standard TEI tags. I've just taken, Ernie just brought 7 CDs of audio, the first audio that we have in the project, which we're looking forward to getting home and investigating. We can encode the transcriptions of the audio in TEI as well. We can use timeline elements and when elements to align the transcriptions. And finally, as we've said before, we're doing documentation. All of that stuff we can do in TEI. Every time a new need arises, we turn around and there's a TEI chapter that deals with that need. So far it's worked really well for us. Now the next problem was although we're using TEI, most lexicon projects are not using TEI. And we felt like we ought to be looking at interoperability. So we started to investigate how we might convert this data. Converting XML to XML is trivial in the sense that an XSLT transformation will take you from one kind of XML to the other if you can map it correctly. But you need to choose a schema. Now, I have a list of about 9 different candidates. Budan, Majewski, and Mirth listed 9 different ones in their paper last year in the TEI journal. But we came down to 3 candidates, the LMF16DTD, which is the part of the ISO 2008 standard. The Relish project lists 5 drawbacks with that DTD, which we agree with. I won't go into them here, but among them the fact that it's not modular, the fact that it's a DTD, and the fact that we can't find any actual lexicon projects which are using it, so we have no sample code. We looked at Lyft, and we saw that Lyft is supported by WeSay, Flex, and Lexi Pro. Great, but we know software goes away. We're not going to choose a standard because some software supports it, because the software won't be there eventually. And when we looked at the Lyft spec, it seems to be at version 0.13, and there's been hardly any work on it in the last couple of years. So I may be missing something, but it looked like that community is kind of not very vibrant. And we looked at Relish, and Relish looked like the best candidate for us. It's modular, it's in relaxing schemas, it allows for TEI feature structures. And so we thought, great, we will brandish our data at the world in Relish format. And we started to do that. And this is an example from the Relish documentation of what a lexical entry looks like in Relish, a very simple one, the famous clergyman example that shows up all over the place. And there are 2 features of that which are problematic for us. One is that it requires a lemma. That's mandatory. We don't have lemmas. We haven't got around to figuring out what a lemma means in this particular language and what form we might choose for a particular entry. The second is that it uses feature structures almost immediately. there is very little encoding beyond feature structures. Now, feature structures are great, and they enable us to link to the ISO CAT data category registry, but there's a problem with feature structures. Basically, when you choose feature structures, you devolve or you transfer the burden of interoperability from the tag system to the nomenclature or the ontology. You all have to agree on what part of speech means and what common noun means. So relish depends on feature structures. Feature structures depend on a shared ontology, and that's a problem for us. And it's a problem that I have to hand off to Eva because it's no longer a technical problem.
So basically our time is up, so I'm just gonna talk about this very, very quickly and just tell you what the problem is. The problem is that our feature structures are based on a morphological analysis of Nhang Jin, which itself was based on a kind of traditional Salishianist analysis as proposed by the work of Kincaid, and also that was modified by subsequent work of mine and also of Marie-Louise Willits. And this morphological analysis proposes a particular set of categories and relationships between those categories, and the problem is, of course, that they don't entirely match up to gold, and how do you deal with that? So there's, you know, some categories that we can easily map onto gold. There's other cases where we can add categories. That's easy. But there's a large set of cases which only map onto gold loosely. And yes, we can deal with them. But how do we do that in a way that doesn't take a lot of time? So our conclusion at the moment is that ultimately, it's a really good idea for different kinds of systems to be able to communicate with each other, so interoperability is great. Format conversion is trivial, but true interoperability depends on a shared ontology, which in turn depends on a shared grammatical analysis, and that is going to take time to develop. And right now, what's important is to get this project finished and to make it properly accessible to the community. And so at the moment, it doesn't make sense for us to take the time to develop the ontology. So, Lam Lat.
Questions? Well, go ahead.
Thank you. This was inspiring and good to see, as a member of the Relish project, that you considered it and you looked at
Mark
it.
Mark wants to talk to you.
Okay. On your previous slide, you had not just GOAT but also IsoCAT, and I think indeed that IsoCAT would be the way to go for registering your categories which are language-specific or project-specific or analysis-specific, theory-specific, or whatever. But you could register them there and then link them to existing category and say, is loosely the same, or is a subtype of, or something.
Using RelCat.
Yeah, using RelCat, exactly, yeah. But for your practical concern to give something back to the community now, I guess your pragmatic approach is completely appropriate. But for having the resources later interoperable, and Relish aims at having interoperability between the LIFT format and LMF, so that is indeed something which I think is a good way to go.
Well, we really wanted to do what you're suggesting, but we decided that it's not a priority right now. There's the funding for this particular phase of the project ends on September 30th of this year. So the goal, it just doesn't make sense to take the time to do that until afterwards. Pat, did you have a question?
Yes, I was really interested in your categorization of essentially zero morphemes. And I noticed that you had a zero for a third person object. Can you just talk a little bit about the functionality of the including it and what your decisions were to include it as opposed to not?
Well, it's partly there because that was a decision that Dale and I made in 1991.
I should say I like the conclusion, but I'd
like Yeah, and it's also partly there because, you know, there are these morphemes that combine various categories. And from the point of view of a morphological dictionary, that information needs to be encoded. And so it seemed like the easiest way to do that. And Martin was able to make it work. So that's why we continue doing it. I guess that's the answer.
Does it have any drawbacks?
Actually, we haven't found any. It's been surprisingly easy to convert from LexWare to TEI. you know, of course, we're constantly changing the code, which is also somewhat frustrating because, you know, it takes time away from just finishing the editing. But still, we seem to be able to do pretty well anything that we need to do. Andrew?
Yeah, I assume that probably one reason why people don't use TEI very much is that people are used to Toolbox and Flex and so on, which are lexicographically very much more unsophisticated than TEI is. And it is, of course, trivial to do the XML conversion in a sense, but it's also difficult if you don't understand the structure of TEI. And I think one thing that you might that might be useful for a lot of linguists who aren't familiar with TEI would be to write a style sheet that converts the XML output of Toolbox or Flex into a TEI format, and that would be a way for people to kind of explore it a little bit.
Do you want to collaborate with somebody else?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. I should also mention that some of you will know Lauren Romery and Verna Weisstein. They have been working on the idea that TEI should be a formal serialization of the LMF abstract standard. And I like that idea because it would force a specific TEI-based schema, which is more restrictive than the standard, very permissive schema in TEI, that we could all kind of agree on and would be LMF compliant. We need to do some to push forward with some modifications to TEI before we can make that work. But I think that might be a good way to go.
The screenshot that you showed us, what was that? When you clicked on
I'll show you the dictionary
and so on, because you spoke about the,
This is the website of our dictionary, which is live at the moment. And the green thing means we've finished these entries, or at least we've finished the first pass through these entries. There are amber entries and there are red entries as well. You click on an entry, it will go off and gets the entry back by AJAX. And then you've got the components of the entry here, and you can click on one of these. So this is the working interface for our dictionary that we all refer to and we all use. And Ernie and Sharon are helping to make this interface comprehensible to the people back in Colville tribes who are helping us with information. And we have, you'll see down here, where is it there? There's a question for elders here. We've embedded these all through the dictionary, and you can click on there and it will pop up an email which has the right subject heading and the right XML ID and the question, and they can answer that question. And we've just been we've just got going with this, and we think it's going to work well.
Is it working?
And we also have three different views of the data. I mean, if you want to use it as a basic user, you don't see so much. If you want to use it as a learner, you see a little bit more, and the full view is basically for all of us who are working on the project.
And what does it take you to go from the underlying XML to this, like, just some style sheets or something more complicated?
I have an answer in the presentation somewhere. These are things we didn't have time to talk about. There we go. It's an exist XML database. So we use, there we go. When your browser makes a request, it goes to the controller in the exist database. An X query asks for the information from the database. The XML result comes out, is transformed through XSLT into XHTML, and there's also CSS and JavaScript that comes out here back. It's a standard exist project using exist 2.0. We love exist. It has its quirks.
Thank you. Also got a lexicographic question. As well, in TEI, as well in LMF, I always run in the problem of, well, myself being a toolbox user of the olden times and used to the hierarchical thinking. So if you have a complex entry, and some of the meanings would be associated to noun and another one to verb, so you have a hierarchical structure, right? Noun, and then below noun, first sense, second sense, and then verbal, and then first and second. And all those other formats, TEI included, as far as I understand, but LMF in any case, put form and sense side by side. You can't really have this hierarchical order either way, right? In the old toolbox times, you could choose between if you would like to have the sense as the primary ordering criteria and part of speech as secondary or the other way around. Anyway, so the solution which I saw in all projects where I participated was to have really one basic atom entry for each sense, and then later do the linking and saying actually these two senses could be combined in something which then could be visualized as a complex entry.
Right.
Is that the way that you went when you had similar problems of polysemy?
That's a hard question, because it's a question for both of us, and part of the answer to that is the way we inherited the data.
Well, Lexer is very much hierarchically based, and so when we were working on it in the 1990s, it was actually very difficult to try and figure out what was a sub-entry, and what was an entry, and what was a sub-sub-entry, and so on. And so then when we tried to convert it, we wanted to keep as much of the morphological analysis as possible, because that was a very important component for Dale and also for me. But at the same time, we didn't want to have the kind of complexity and the questions that came up with Lexware. And so we actually made it quite flat. And it seems to be, because you can link morphemes, you can link XML IDs to each other, it's possible to put a lot of relationships into the linking, then you don't have to put them into the actual entries. Does that answer your question?
Halfway, but let's discuss it
later.
Yeah.
I think in a simple sense, if you had a form and a sense that went together, and another form and another sense that went together, we would probably have two separate entries, but we could cross-reference them. And of course, if they share morphemes, so they're automatically linked, they show up inside each other's entries.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, is that all the time we have?